In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I give our updates on Drip and Bluetick. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 328. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So where this week, sir?
Well, as I said on a previous podcast, I think we last recorded about 2 weeks ago, and last week was the interview with Wade Foster. But last week I was at an alternative conference up in Vermont called Big Snow Tiny Conf.
Nice. Why do you say alternative? Was there like bands there playing emo music?
Well, you know, it's the whole alternative facts thing.
Alternative
facts. Alternative conference.
Nice. So that was cool. And Brian Castle runs that, and you were there with what, 10, 11 folks?
Yeah, it was about a dozen people up there. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. The weather was a little bit better this year. The first day of skiing was absolutely phenomenal. And then the next day, I got a little bit tired near the end of the day. And I'm just like, I'm just not going to go back up there, because if I do, I'm probably going to get hurt. So I decided to skip out on probably an hour or two of skiing, which wasn't too bad. But yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. I think that virtually everyone who was there was also going to MicroConf this year as well.
What was your highlight of a conference? I mean, it's not really a conference. I think that's a misnomer. It's like a group. It's like a mastermind group, you know, or which is super cool. But a conference is like, I think of it like with people standing in front, and sometimes there's sponsor tables and such. So
right. Well, I mean, the thing is, everybody gives a brief presentation or a talk or a topic for discussion, and we go through like a dozen of them over the course of those three days. So I think the first day we did like two or three, and then the next one we did four or five, and then the next day after that we did another four or five. So we just ski for like half a day, and then there's just talks and presentations and stuff like that for the rest of it. And it's really interesting to see the types of things that people are working on that you either just wouldn't think of as a business, or you wouldn't think of how to do those things as like marketing plans or things that you can do to find customers or to drive sales. It's just really impressive to see the types of things that people come up with.
Yeah, I bet. It's nice to get in-depth exposure like that to other people's businesses. I think that a conference or a gathering of this size, there's a real unique aspect to it. You and I have talked about doing a super small, you know, we didn't even know if we were going to land at the MicroConf name, but it was going to be something like 30 or 40 people, and getting them together over the course of a few days. And, you know, Big Snow Tiny is even smaller than that. So I can imagine there being a lot of, especially if there's good chemistry between the attendees, I bet you could get a lot of varied and good advice from experienced founders, because that's the cool thing, right? It's not 11 people who are dreaming of starting a business. Like, I would guess that everyone there has a business and is making money, and you all have different experiences, so you're going to get a lot of valuable, some not valuable probably. You know, if someone's running an e-commerce site and you're telling them about your churn rate, like, maybe that person doesn't have a good opinion or a experienced opinion on it, but I'd imagine the majority of stuff you come away with is pretty detailed and pointed towards your kind of your particular case. Is that, I'm conjecturing here, is that kind of how it feels?
I would say so. I mean, to kind of correct you on a couple of things, there were, in terms of where people are at, there was one guy named Chris who had started a business literally a week before, and it was based around running Facebook ads to drive traffic to a website, and then you pay a couple of dollars and you can have a physical letter mailed to like a congressional member of your district, or, you know, a senator or something along those lines. So basically what he does is he looks up the information of where to send that letter, and then uses geolocation based on where you're at, and says, these are the people that you would send this letter to. And he, by the way, here's a template, and it's related to whatever the issue is that you are interested in. So if he drove ads based on like EPA stuff, or, you know, gun control or what have you, he's got
immigration.
Immigration. Like, he's got all these things, you know, like templated, and based on which side of the issue you're on, he will give you the template. You can customize it, and then he will send it for you for a couple of dollars.
It's pretty cool.
And he started it like a week ago, and he was literally printing them out and putting stamps on them and mailing them. And he's like, this is all, I'm just validating, just kind of seeing what's here. He's like, it's interesting. It may not turn into nothing, but to me, it was interesting. It was extremely interesting to see what he was doing and how he was doing it. And we all gave him feedback, and we're all like, double your prices, double your prices.
Right. Well, and it's cool to see someone validating like that. Those are the fun days. Like, I, as stressful as they are, because you don't know if you should do it or not, like, the validating stuff is, it's just new ideas, you know, they're actually putting into practice. So that's kind of cool. Kind of cool someone attended at that stage.
Yeah. And then, you know, you've kind of got the flip side where, like, a guy named Chad Deshaun was there, and he ran a Kickstarter campaign where he did like $2.6 million in sales of like board game tables. So he talked a little bit about his experience outsourcing to China and having things brought over. And it was really interesting seeing, I'll say, both ends of the spectrum, where you've got somebody who's just starting out. They literally just started trying to validate this idea. And then somebody else on the other end where, like, they've already got the money. They're basically trying to get their logistics pipeline down to deliver everything to people. And it's just, you know, amazing to see the differences between those stories. And they're both interesting, I think.
Yep. No, I agree. Speaking of board game tables, if you're into board games, you need to check out boardgametables.com. That's Chad's business. Those tables are awesome. I have been eyeballing one for a long time. Just love that you can cover it up and leave, you know, as a felt surface, but it's sunk down. And so you have this big, you know, let's say you have a big D&D game spread out. It looks like hell. And you're going to run that for months, right? If you have a long campaign, but you can like cover it so that, and that's the big plus for me, is that then it looks like a real table on top. So anyways, and there's cup holders, and it's just designed perfectly to play board games. So a little plug for Chad there. I've been a fan of the tables for a while.
So what about you? You went to SASTR last week, I believe?
I did, yeah. So I was in San Francisco with several folks from the Lead Pages crew. And as expected, you know, SASTR was, they said it was 10,000 people. I'm not sure if it was actually that many. It didn't feel that big, but it was, yeah, it was a big conference. And the most value I got was from kind of the team building, like the camaraderie of hanging out with the folks from Lead Pages, because I don't often get to hang out with five or six others at once. You know, we had dinner together, we were doing happy hours together. I mean, it was just a fun time where you can really dig into some interesting conversations. You know, there are only so many people in the world that have that much in common with you and know that much about like your business and what you do, and you know what they're up to. And I was talking to the CFO, and he's like, "What do you think? What'd you think? You know, if we just did this to pricing?" And it's like, "Oh, what a cool thought experiment!" You know. And then I was able to say, "Well, we tried that, and it did this, or here's my opinion." And it was just like, you would never set up meetings to talk about these kind of, you know, high level just things that you've had, you know, almost thought experiments, to be honest. And yet doing it can be really fun. So I enjoyed that part of it. So I ran into a couple people and I set up a couple meetings with folks, but overall, like my crowd, I kind of went through my whole Rolodex, like who of all the MicroConf speakers from the past several years, like is anyone here? And they weren't. I was thinking maybe Heaton or Stella would be there, Jason Cohen, Dan Martell, just anybody, because I would love to connect with them. And they weren't there. So I ran into a few people, but overall, it was probably not something I'll be going back to. It was just too big. The sessions are interviews and panels, which I don't get a lot of value out of because they're just not actionable. And I can hear them on podcasts. So I think you really go there for the networking. And the networking was actually, you know, with my own coworkers. So I started thinking it might have been cheaper if we spent a couple happy hours, you know, with the same crew. So that's my opinion of it. I respect the heck out of Jason Lemkin and like the SASTR brand, and I like what they're up to, but the conference that big is just not for me.
I think that's a great way to, you know, get company funded happy hours. I think that's what you're going for here.
Totally right. That was it. So, hey, so this week, by popular demand, you know, we get requests to hear more about what we're up to. And we like to do update episodes every once in a while. Frankly, we could probably start doing them a bit more frequently. But today we're going to talk through some stuff that's been going on recently with me and Drip. And then we're going to dive into what you've been up to with Blue Tick. It's been a few months, I think, since an update. And I think there's a lot to be said here. So to kind of kick us off, Drip is continuing to grow. And it's growing quickly. And since we were, you know, acquired by Lead Pages 7.5 months ago, I think we have 6 times more users than we did. I mean, it's just this crazy fast growth. It may even be more than that. It might be like 7. So it's a lot. And we have 7 times the number of trials coming through each month. I mean, it's just, you know, at every scale, you imagine just almost 10xing in every direction. And so that has been a focus of ours, just scaling the technology. So we hired a couple more engineers a couple months ago. I just hired one. We hired a front end who'll start in a month. And then we have an open, you know, Ruby on Rails position. And these are good problems to have, right? It's like, you know, you need to scale stuff up. But what we're trying to do is, you know, continue to ship features, because that was a thing for a couple months. We almost spent a lot of time just getting enough servers up to keep handling the queues and to keep everything running. We're definitely out, you know, knock on wood, we're out ahead of that right now. But that does continue to kind of be a focus. We have basically 2 full-time engineers now. All they do is scaling and performance. and they're just rewriting, they're refactoring, they're adding servers, they're figuring out what's going on here. I mean, it's now, you know, I think I've said it before, now I understand how you can get an engineering team of 20 or 30 people on a product, because you just have so much stuff that you are trying to keep going.
Yeah, I'm curious about that a little bit more, because, you know, if you were at a certain scale before, and you were obviously at some point we're probably running into scaling issues to begin with, you're looking 7.5 months down the road, and you multiply your size by 6 from where you started. That's a lot. I mean, you're adding basically an entire customer base just about every month at that point. So what sorts of things have you run into that, you know, have been especially difficult or challenging to resolve? I mean, are there things that came up that just you would never have in a million years have dreamed that you would have run into that, and like suddenly now it's a problem?
There are a lot of edge cases that come up where, so there's two things. One is just scaling to that level. Another one is when you're sending, you know, tens of millions of emails and you have thousands and thousands of customers, the littlest bizarre edge case is just bound to come up. So we do find ourselves kind of troubleshooting things and trying to figure out how to best handle those. But in terms of scaling, I think there's kind of three fronts, and probably four, but one is just the database. Like we've continued to have to increase the size of the hardware that it runs on and give it more RAM and then give it more IOPS. They're called IO per second, that allows reads and writes to the disk. And I find about every 4 months we have to increase something on that. And it's nice that Amazon keeps pace and it continues to add larger and larger server instances, because I don't think, you know, at our current pace, knock on wood, I don't think we're going to outgrow what they have to offer. But the place where that we hit probably about 3 months ago was when there was one aspect of Drip where, you know, it was where you go in and you can just create ad hoc subscriber queries. Basically, you can just create a segment and you're like, anyone who has this tag and hasn't visited this page and has opened this email, right? I mean, we just basically let you and you're almost building a SQL query, but it's just with a nice visual interface. That can get incredibly complicated, as you can imagine. I mean, some people will OR together 10 things, and that's like joining on 10 tables in the database, and some of which have a billion rows, right? So that doesn't scale. And we eventually hit the point where no matter how much hardware we threw at it, for our largest customers, it was still not fast enough. So that was the big one that we really, you know, had to have that breakthrough on. And I talked about it on the show a few months ago, where like we were going to shard the database, which is just catastrophically complicated. And we figured out a workaround. And it was this way too technical to go into here, but we figured out a way to just completely rethink and rewrite that whole piece of it, the subscriber querying, to where we're not querying the database live. And we've seen 10x and up to 100x speed improvements on that. It just completely changed the game. And so that was kind of the biggest pain point. And I think that improvement alone will give us a year, 2-3 years of more expansion now, which is a really good feeling to have. And that's not to say other parts of the app won't experience slowdowns. You know, your reports are always going to slow down as you get more data in the database, other things like that. We are also adding read replicas now, right? We don't just have a master database with a hot backup, which is what we've had for a few years. We're now starting to add other replicated databases that we can hit and not impact. You know, you're just reading from them, right? But so we don't impact the main database. So those have probably been the biggest scaling things recently that we've been tackling.
I think dealing with that centralized storage in the background for like the database itself that's the hardest thing. I've seen a lot of different strategies for people doing that. Like some of them just say, oh, well, we have a separate database instance for each customer. And I guess that's one way to go. So you don't have like a multi-tenant database. It's just each customer has their own. But there's all sorts of other operational challenges with doing that. So like, if you have to make a schema update, for example, you have to make it across every single customer's database. And that's not always the easiest thing to do in the world. So yeah, it's just kind of interesting to see the types of things that you're running into. And from my perspective, I'm kind of thinking about the things that I might run into, because you had just said, for example, the customers can create their own ad hoc queries. And that's something that I started looking at. And then I realized how complicated it was going to get and how difficult it could end up being because of performance issues. And I kind of backed off from it. And I just said, look, it'll just make it simplified for now, and we'll come back to it later.
I think that's a good call. Yep. I like that we have this feature, but it has obviously been quite a bit to keep up with, because as soon as you allow ad hoc stuff, people will build crazy stuff and they expect it to work. So I would almost lean to, especially in the early days, lean towards not having it and having just a few canned things that people could do.
Like in terms of like the other aspects, though, I mean, obviously, like just dealing with the scaling challenges alone is one problem. But what about building new features? And what about like customer support and onboarding? Like, do you have any things that get escalated from the customer support side that you need to deal with? Because I mean, I've been running into some of this stuff recently where a single customer support problem can chew up easily a several hours of time.
Right. You know, luckily, and to LeadPage's credit, pretty quickly after we moved over, they started adding support people from their team, and then they started hiring, I think they hire externally now. And we went from one support person when we were acquired, one full-time, and I think we have six or seven full-time now. And I have had to pretty much do zero work on that. And that's the kind of thing that, because right, how else could we have scaled that? I mean, I wouldn't have had the time to hire that many support people. And they've done it with customer success. They've done it with sales. They've done it with marketing. You know, all those aspects I've been able to hand off has freed me up to be able to focus on exactly this, right? I focus on scaling, focus on shipping features and hiring. So it's pretty rare that stuff gets escalated. The support team is very, very good. And most stuff doesn't come back to me anymore. There's just enough layers who know how to make judgment calls. And it's pretty, pretty rare something comes back to me. And that's a support side, which feels great, to be honest. I mean, as much as supporting your app is something you have to do, it's not necessarily something as product people that we want to do. It doesn't move the core product forward, which tends to be, you know, my focus. In terms of shipping features, we slowed down, I'd say, for the first couple months after the acquisition, and then we started speeding back up, and we've been at a pretty even keel hiring pace of an engineer every month, maybe every two. That's allowed us to continue to ramp people up, and like the two engineers we hired a couple months ago are like fully ramped up, and they're shipping a lot of features now. So we're probably at a faster pace than we were before the acquisition, even with the scaling. And that's purely just hiring new senior people who can get up to speed and, you know, in a month and get it out. So I'm pretty excited right now. I mean, I go through stressful times of, oh no, are we going to scale? Are we shipping fast enough? And right now I'm like pretty optimistic based on who we have and all the stuff that's almost, there's a bunch of features that are like almost done, you know? And that's a good feeling to have, right? It's not like everyone's bouncing around. It's like there's some things that are with literally three or four pretty cool features within a few weeks of shipping right now. And so depending on how we roll those out, that's exciting because I think shipping features is what we do. That's the dopamine rush.
Very cool. So what else? What else is kind of on tap for you guys?
Yeah, I think just to round it out, wrap up my part, basically the free plan is still going strong, and that's got us a lot of notoriety in the space. And, you know, free plan's a long-term play, right? And it's something that takes a lot of time and focus from a certain group of people to make that work. You don't just start a free plan and then, hey, people magically convert to paid. It's like you have to be very strategic about what's the limit on the free plan, how do you think about getting people on a value that they get to that limit. And so there's a couple people, at least two or three, who are thinking about this a lot, and customer success is working on it. And, you know, so far so good. It's a long-term play. A few people have asked me, like, how's the free plan working out? And it's like, it's working, but it's like, you can't even tell until months after you start this thing, until you get enough numbers to actually be able to make a judgment call on it. So it's, I can't say, oh my gosh, this is, you know, it's the most amazing thing ever, and we're going to do it forever. And I also can't say, oh, it's not working. It's kind of like, yeah, the early signs, even though we're months in, like the early signs are that things are going well, and it's bringing, you know, a lot of new folks our way. So that's it for me. Let's talk about Bluetick. And for those who don't know, it's also an email app, but it's not really email marketing. It's called bluetick.io. And you want to give the one sentence description of what it does?
Yeah, so it's essentially a way of systematically and automatically following up via email with people that are, I'll say, later on in your sales funnel. So kind of like after they've gotten into your marketing funnel, they have expressed some interest. This will essentially help move them through that early sales process where you've got a warm lead who has expressed some interest of some kind, whether they opened up a bunch of emails or they sent you an email and saying, hey, you know, we just wanted to talk a little bit more about this. And then you can use it to push them into like a conference call or something like that. And if they don't respond to the first email, that'll send them another one and send them another one and kind of move them through that process automatically. So you don't have to think about, oh, is this the second email I've sent them? Is it the third? How long did I wait? And you don't have to manage that process at all. It just does it for you.
You realize that was more than one sentence, right?
Yeah, I know. I was giving examples of what I could do beyond that.
So you took pre-orders, you had some folks pay you, I forget, how much was it, the pre-orders?
I gave people the option more because I was just fleshing it out. So I said, you set your own price and then tell me how many months of service that you're willing to essentially prepay for. And people paid anywhere from, I think it was around $40 a month to $100. And there was one that was at $100. Everyone else was between $40 and $50. So then I basically went back to them. And my final pricing at this point is $50 a month.
And so have all the folks who pre-ordered from you, have they had a chance to get into the app and dig in? And how is that going in terms of converting them?
So I onboarded all of them, and that I would say I definitely made some mistakes in that aspect. So what I did was I said, when I took the pre-orders, I said, I'll onboard you and I won't start charging you until you're seeing value from it. And the problem is that because that is such an open-ended thing, it doesn't force it to the top of their priority list. So this month, what I've kind of started doing is going back to them and saying, look, I need to draw this line in the sand for anyone who's placed a pre-order, and I'm trying to put it towards the end of this month, which I may end up being 3 weeks out or 4 weeks out or something like that. But there's going to be a line in the sand that says, look, up until this point, let's get you onboarded as a paying customer and convert your extended trial over into a paid subscription, or let's kill it. And if it's not going to help you, or if you just don't have time.
Yeah. And that's a good way to go. That's why like free trials work, right? Rather than, you know, often, especially if you're a beginner, like free plans versus free trial is a different thing. And the difference is free trial has an expiration date. And whether you do a 14 or a 21 or a 30 or a 60 or whatever it is, at some point there is that line in the sand. And that's some time pressure to get someone to commit or not. And so, you know, I think it's very good that you're switching to that. In the early days of Drip, when I had pre-order folks in there, I said the same thing, right? Once you get value out of it, we'll do it. And then about every week or two, I would email them. And I had all these emails boomeranging back to me. And when I got a boomerang from someone, I would log in and I would look and see, what are they doing in Drip? Have they actually imported a list? Are they sending emails? And then I would ping them and I'd be like, hey, I see you're not sending emails. Are you interested? Let's get this moving forward. And if they had emails, then my question became, hey, do you think you're getting enough value out of Drip to pay $49 a month now? So that was it. And then I'd follow up every 2 weeks, and eventually some people converted. I think most people converted, and some didn't, and that was okay. So I hear you. It sounds like you didn't do that early enough. You said you kind of made a mistake with it. Like you didn't have enough time, not even time pressure, but maybe enough follow-up. It's kind of funny. Follow-up. You could have run them through BlueTick.
Actually, I am at this point. So,
oh, that's cool.
I basically set up all the automation for that. So it's now going out to them, and I've got a whole sequence of emails that's being sent out to them. So if anyone's listening, yes, those are completely automated emails at this point. But no, I think for me, it was an initial hesitation to kind of really push forward, because I kind of had it in my head like, oh, I made a mental promise to these people, like you can have this until it provides value, but that doesn't do them any favors and it doesn't do me any favors. It's not helpful to either one of us. So there really needs to be that emphasis on some sort of a timeline or, you know, reckoning, so to speak, to just say, look, this, it's got to move forward, or if it doesn't, that's okay. I just need to know. So.
Right. You got to channel your inner salesperson and ask for the close, right? So cool. And you were telling me offline that did you add a couple more customers?
Yeah, just yesterday I added one new customer. And then yesterday I also converted one of the prepaid customers into a paid subscriber. So I gave him basically a 20% lifetime discount, applied his prepayment as a credit. So he'll have several months of the service. And then after that, it'll start charging him on a regular basis, but basically gave him a credit for that and just said, yes, now it's providing value. So let's just start charging you, and we'll cut into that credit.
That's cool. Always good to get new customers. And is that your plan to keep getting? Because we had talked about a while back, you were going to do a public launch, but it sounds like you've continued to kind of add a couple customers here and there every few weeks. What is the plan right now? Which direction are you headed?
Yeah. So I was talking about this to my mastermind group last month, and it was kind of around the last time that we discussed it here on the podcast. And they actually talked me out of going through and doing the launch on the 31st of January.
Why is that? Yeah. What was their argument?
Their argument was they didn't feel like I had pushed enough people through the system and it wasn't getting enough usage to help me identify the places where I would run into problems in terms of support or scaling or just answering questions accurately or in a way that doesn't overwhelm me. And I looked back at it at the time. I said, well, you know, maybe you guys are right. And I look back at it now in retrospect, it was like, yeah, you guys were definitely right. I really needed to back that off, because there's times where I will burn through an entire morning just going back and forth with people on support calls. I mean, I did it this morning as well, where somebody will say, hey, how do I do this? Or got this problem here. Or I'm trying to import a bunch of people. And what's the syntax for this or that? And I've got, you know, support documentation, but I'm starting to find that there's places where it's just incomplete. And there are a lot of edge cases where the questions just simply aren't answered because they're not well documented in the documentation. Like I can go in the code and look at it and I can tell the person how it is, but that doesn't help them because they can't just go to the support site and just pull it up because it's not well documented.
documentation, like KBs are so, they're so time consuming to get started. I remember when we first started Drip, it's just like, there's so much information that's embedded in your head and in the code, and trying to translate that into helpful articles and figuring out what people need help with. It's hard. It is really hard. And if you recall, our early docs for Drip was me recording screencasts, and that it was purely a time thing. I just did not have time to write that all out. And, you know, I got mixed emotion from that. People said, yeah, this is fine for now. But like, they often, somebody was in an airport and the Wi-Fi wasn't fast enough. And then another person was saying, I don't want to watch a 3-minute screencast. I just wanted to skim an article. And of course, creating an article takes a heck of a lot more time. I later circled back and paid someone to turn those screencasts into articles, right? Like, not to just transcribe it, but to actually turn it into a well-written thing, take screenshots. And then once we hired, you know, we had a customer success person who had some free time. He then became the KB czar, and he just started cranking out KB things. But as a one-person show, there's no chance you just don't have the time to do all that. At best, in my opinion, you're going to respond via email, and then you're going to take that response, you're going to paste it into a KB article, and it's not going to have screenshots, and it's not going to be fully fleshed out, but it's going to be something. And I think that's probably where you need to start.
Yeah, that's honestly like what most of my KB articles are right now, is people asked me how to do something, and I took some screenshots, and I sent it over to them, and then I took those same screenshots, and I posted them into the KB article and said, this is how you do this.
Yep, that's how you do it.
And it's, you know, it's quick and dirty, but it works, and it doesn't suck up a huge amount of my time. But then there's things where, you know, how does this need to be formatted? And I'm like, I don't actually know, because that's a library that I use. So then I have to go figure it out and then come back to them with the answers. And of course, while I'm doing that, I also add in a couple of unit tests to be like, hey, does this actually work? Because if the library gets updated, for example, and whatever gets through, like, I want to make sure that those things still work later on.
Right. So you've backed off from the public launch, the mastermind group. And here's the thing, your mastermind group has more intimate knowledge than any of us, including me, right? But certainly more than any of our listeners in terms of exactly where you are, how things are going, just because they get so much more in-depth information about it. So, and I think I know the folks in your group, and I trust if they're recommending that, I actually think that's probably the right way to go. So it's because you're not far enough. Do they not think you have product market fit and you still need to tweak some things and get some more features out? Or is it that they, I guess, feeling like support, I think you mentioned like support might not be able to scale or something. And that's, I don't know, that sounds kind of like, well, maybe work a few extra hours or hire someone to help you part-time with that. Like, I would probably dive in and not try to pre-scale stuff like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think what they're looking for is me to get to somewhere between 20 and 30 paying customers before I kind of flip the switch. I think there's a difference between having people who are on the system and using it in name, but not really exercising a lot of things, versus somebody who's paying for it. They're probably in there, they're probably using a lot. And if they're not using it, they're going to cancel. So there's that, I'll say, scale that you get by virtue of just having people pay for it, because they're not going to pay for something they're not using. So by constantly using it and finding bugs or edge cases or integrating it more fully into the automation systems that they have in place, that finds those edge cases. And it also helps me flesh out some of the marketing stuff. I worked with somebody yesterday who said, hey, it'd be really great if when somebody finishes this email sequence, if it could go over to Pipedrive and just automatically close out that deal or whatever. And I'm like, oh, actually, you can do this, and you can actually do it now. You don't have to wait for anything. And I sent them screenshots, and I basically walked them through and said, this is exactly how to set that up. But that's not something that is going to come up until I get to that point where lots of people are, or enough, a kind of a critical mass of people are using it that let me know that, hey, I have this question, how do you do this? And then those different use cases can end up on the sales website to help attract more customers. So it kind of feeds back into itself at some point.
Yeah, that makes sense. I do think that 20 to 30 paying customer mark is about the point where you really know that stuff is working. And then, of course, you realize when you get to 100 customers that you really didn't know that stuff was working, but at least you know something. You know, I think that's, if I recall, that's about where it was, somewhere between 20 and 30 with Drip, where we basically started doing those launches to the 300 to 600 emails on our list at a time. So yeah, it sounds like you still got more work to do. And that's the thing, is like, launching is, you could launch today, right? You could just send out an email and get everybody in. And you may bleed everyone out because you don't have product market fit, or you may not be able to support them, and so they get pissed off and leave, or your onboarding may not be good enough or existent in existence, you know, and so you're not going to convert them. And so I, yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with that. I think the danger and stuff that you and I have talked about over the years with AutoShark is that the launch just keeps getting pushed out. Is it that you never get to that 20 to 30 customer mark? So, but I guess at this point, your number one goal and focus should be getting to that mark. Is that the idea? It's like getting one person a week, two people a week, whatever it takes. And when you hit that, then you're able to pull the trigger.
Yeah. Heaton Shaw's got a newsletter that he sends out, and there was, I think he's kind of switched. I don't know whether it's the same newsletter or not, but he's sending out something to his email list basically saying, kind of what's the one thing that moves the needle for you at this point. And I kind of read it and I thought about it. And the one thing was basically moving people from either a trial into a paid subscription or just adding paid customers to get them, because those are the types of people who are going to be actively using it versus the software kind of sitting there in the background and possibly not doing very much for them. And I think that just, my focus at this point is just adding paying customers. So one of the people who had signed up yesterday, I started redoing some of the sign up stuff on Friday. So he couldn't sign up on Tuesday when he wanted to. So I ended up, pushing them off, and I said, I'll give you an invitation code. We'll get you set up and then we'll process your credit card later. So I ended up doing that, but he was thinking, I'll just log in and then I'll hook up my billing stuff. And I was like, nah, the billing stuff inside the app isn't there yet. And I honestly don't care. It doesn't need to be there right now. I can do that stuff manually, but I'm actively looking for ways to avoid touching any of that stuff because the product works. It does what it needs to do. So at this point, it's a matter of getting that marketing message right, getting the people in and getting them using it. And that's my focus, is finding people who will actively use it.
Yep. And I think as your number one goal, I would focus less on, at this point, on trying to scale documentation or on trying to have stuff that people can find. And you're going to need to do, I think, a lot of handholding for the time being. And I know it chews up time and you can't really work on the product necessarily, but that one-on-one time for those first 20 customers is going to be extremely, extremely valuable. And I mean, I think, if you have your launch list, you could start emailing one of those at a time. Like email, maybe do it in blocks of five or something, but like pick five off the list. Whether if you've surveyed them and you could tell which you're most interested, you could start with the most, or you could just go with the most recent and email five of them and be like, individually, like coming from Mike to one person, not a BCC, and be like, hey, super interested getting you on board. You signed up for this. Here's the big thing, still in early access, and trying to get one at a time, get people onboarded. Is that what you're up to at this point?
Yes. This past week, I replaced a couple of pieces on the main page where previously it just had the email course and it didn't really say much about how you could sign up. But now I've replaced that, and there's a request invitation area on the right at the top of the main page. And if you enter in your email address, what it does at that point is it kicks you over to another page where there is a survey and it asks you to fill that out. And then those replies go directly to me, and it gives me some marketing information. But if somebody signs up for that and then goes through and fills out the survey, then I know that they are essentially more interested and I can pay attention to those people a little bit more. The other thing I can do is go through, you talked about emailing people individually. I can literally export my list of subscribers from Drip and put them into Bluetick and then just say, hey, go ahead and just start emailing these people individually, because that's what it does. It emails people one-on-one, and I can send them into a sequence and try and get a response from them of some kind, depending on what it is that I'm trying to get them to do, whether it's that survey or have a call or what have you.
That's cool. I like it. I think you got stuff. Well, I think you're making progress on the right things,
Yeah. And it is hard to figure out what is the right thing to be doing today or this week. I mean, at a high level, I know it's get people in who are most likely to convert into a paying user, because that's kind of a proxy for getting value out of it. But there's all these other little things that kind of factor into that. And then, as I said, somebody can email you something and then it burns through 3 or 4 hours if you trying to figure out how to best help them and how to let them know, like, this is what they need to do, or this is how to do it, or trying to do it for them and then show them after the fact.
I think two thoughts that I have with that. Number one, I think every task that comes onto your plate, whether you're pulling it off your Trello board or whether an email comes in, I think you need to ask yourself, will this get the next customer onboarded, or will this get the next customer paying me? And if the answer is yes, if it's from a customer who's trying to onboard and they're struggling, then you do it. But if not, and it's from an existing customer who says, hey, can you add this feature? You can totally log that somewhere, but I would not stop then and build the feature, because your goal right now is to get to 20 to 30 customers. And so I would try to laser focus and ask that with every every task that you start.
Yeah, all the stuff that is taking up the most time is people that they've paid and they're going through that onboarding process. And it's mostly like, how do I do this? Or can you do that? And some of it, like I said, it's, oh, it'd be nice to be able to do X, Y, or Z. And I'm like, usually they can already do it. It's just not clear how they get to that point. So then I have to explain it and kind of mentally note it, say, look, I got to explain this better. Or explain it in a way that doesn't make me have to repeat myself 25 times.
Totally. No, that's right. And that is something that as you get through this, you know, as you get more and more customers onboarded, it'll become pretty obvious. Certain things will come up once, don't do anything about it. But certain things come up five times. Well, now you should carve out a KB doc, you know, even a few paragraphs or whatever it is, or improve that tooltip, or, you know, there's something in the app you can do.
Yeah, when the feature requests come in, what I've been doing is just I've been pushing people off and saying, yeah, I'll put that on the roadmap, or usually it's something that's already on the roadmap. And then because I use Fogbug for bug tracking, I'll go in and I'll create a tag with that person's name. And then if the case inside of Fogbugs ends up with enough of those tags to say these five people or these 10 people want it, then I'll kind of push it more towards the top of the list as being much more important. But if it doesn't, then it's usually something that, you know, either surfaced up internally that maybe somebody mentioned in passing or I see it. And those are not technically all that important, because just because I want something in there doesn't mean that it's going to be generally helpful to everybody or everybody's going to use it.
Here's the other thing that kind of comes to mind is said the statement like, it's chewing up time. It took me a few hours to do this, dealing with a customer. I feel like you should hire someone to do something. And it's either going to need to be the engineering side, or it's going to need to be support, or it's going to need to be help with onboarding. And it sounds to me like help with onboarding may be that number one, because support, I think right now, is really heavily intertwined with onboarding, right?
Yeah, they're almost the same thing.
Yep. So I think support and onboarding, you know, again, when I think back to my experience with products, like having someone there in the early days, typically I would do support for about the first 60 days of a product, maybe 90. And then once we had 20 or 30 people, it was just, I was finding someone to help with it. And then maybe a year, I'm trying to think into Drip when we hired Anna, but there was a real game-changing moment when I was able to bring someone on who was a higher level, who wasn't just an email support person, but could actually like get on calls with people and do onboarding, which is something as the founder and the product owner, you think, well, surely no one can do it as well as I can. And what I found out is that Anna was way better at it than I was, because she's just more of a people person and she's just better on the phone. She's better on calls. And sure, the first month she couldn't do it better than I did because I knew the product inside and out. 2 months, 3 months in, it was game changing. And so she became the de facto, she was onboarding. She did some light support. She did strategy stuff of like, oh, here's how you want to set it up. She also did sales, and we never called her that. She was always customer success, but she did the upfront, like, hey, someone is thinking about, you know, using Bluetick, walk them through a demo, you know. And it wasn't a salesy demo. It was a, here's how you would use this. Tell me about what you're up to, blah, blah, blah. And so it's almost a, you know, you think about it, it's like sales slash customer success slash support. But really we just, you know, we called it customer success because it was all about finding the right customers and making them successful. And I think if you found that person, and this sounds like some magical combination that doesn't exist, but I'm now seeing a lot of folks who are able to do this, especially at lead pages. You know, we hired two at Drip. We were a team of 8 full-time and 2 contractors, and 2 of them were customer success, because it was just, we found it so incredibly valuable. Their time was just a multiplier for all of us. And now that we're at lead pages, I don't know. I mean, they must have 10, 15 customer success people who are not just answering email queries all day. They're actually, you know, involved. So that would be my advice to you, is that if at all, if you have any budget, even for part-time, is to look for that person that can take that piece away from it, because that's the piece that you and I as product people, I think are least good at. Like, as much as you and I enjoy talking and we have this good podcast, we're not great on the phone. We're not great demoers, you know, we're not like super people person like some of these folks are naturally. So I'll throw that out there. Like, what do you think about that?
I think it's a good idea. I'll say my hesitation would be the fact that I think that when people first get onto it and start using it, that's when they have the most questions. And then it tends to die down rather quickly. And I feel almost compelled to answer those questions a lot more because I know that they're busy. And if they email me in the middle of the day and they're having a particular problem, I almost feel like I need to kind of drop what I'm doing to help get them through this particular problem, because if I don't, they're more likely to go find something else to do and either not come back to it for a few days or potentially not come back to it for a week or two. So that's my only hesitation with that. And I don't know what the scheduling would be like for somebody who would be doing that, because I couldn't afford to have them full time. But
right. Right. So you'd have to get someone part-time and there'd be a time you're worried about urgency.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess there's other ways to solve that too, which is, for example, I could say, okay, well, I'm only going to onboard people like Thursdays, for example, and then hire somebody and say, hey, look, you know, you only have to work for these couple of hours on second half of the day on Thursday, for example, and that's it. It's like these 4 hours, and then onboard people first thing in the morning and then, you know, let them kind of come through with questions and stuff. And if it comes up after that, the next day or several days later, it's probably not a big deal. It's not as time sensitive. But if I've literally just signed them up and 2 hours later they're emailing me with something, I feel much more compelled to like answer right away.
Yep. I think that's a good way to think about it. You know, and it's tough. I realize it's easy for me to say, hey, you should hire someone who's really good at this with all your free time, because that alone is a big deal trying to find someone. But I think, you know, that your number one goal should be getting new customers in. When I look at multipliers here, like what's going to multiply your time right now? And what's going to multiply and greatly accelerate you getting to 25 or 30 customers? I don't think it's writing more KB articles. You know, I don't think it's other, there's a lot of other things it's not. And answering individual support requests, that's a step towards it, but I don't think that's going to help you get there faster. So, but throughout this conversation, I think that's kind of my one takeaway is if there's something, and I realize, you know, it costs money to hire people. There's all this stuff, but I think if you think creatively about it, I think there could be something there.
I think, I do think that like going back to the one thing though, like I don't know is that onboarding side of things is necessarily the only thing either. I feel like it's more outreach and going to the mailing list and trying to individually follow up with those people and say, hey, you expressed interest in this. Can we have a conversation about it? Or go to the list of other people that I have who I've previously talked to and said, hey, when you get Zapier integration done, let me know. And going to them and saying, hey, let's get you started on this because this stuff is there now and it's working.
Totally. And I think you could still do that, right? You could still be feeding the funnel. And that this other person would basically just you'd hand it off to them in essence and not have to do from the time they sign up, it essentially goes into someone else's responsibility.
Yeah. I'll have to think of a little bit more about how to, you know, arrange that.
Yeah. It's a thought for listeners, like you and I have not talked about Blue Tick since the last time we talked about it on the podcast. So it's not like we talk about this all the time. I'm going just based on the last 20 minutes of information, but that's kind of my impression of where I would probably go next. Cause it doesn't sound like code is your limiting factor right now. Would you say that?
Yeah, I would agree. Like I'm not even touching, like I'm doing small bug fixes here and there, but like other than that, it's like, there's no major stuff being implemented at the moment.
Right. And that's how it feels, you know, because you and I think naturally would be like, well, you should hire a developer, right? Hire the developer so you don't have to do that work anymore. It doesn't sound like that's the right thing to do right now. I don't think that's going to multiply your time. It sounds like there's a lot of support, customer success, and potentially sales that needs to happen. And I think you doing it right now is great. I think very soon you should not be doing it as much. And you are going to have to shift back to the code. And when you do that, this person would be able to seamlessly ease into basically handling all that stuff for you, which I think could be a good thing.
Yep, I agree.
Sounds great. Well, I think we're over time, actually. But again, from what I've heard from folks who listen to these episodes, they really like to hear what we're up to and kind of dig in. So hopefully folks stuck around with us all the way through this point.
Well, as you said, we're out of time. So I think that wraps us up. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupsforrestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.